Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you guys about betonline.ag. We're down to just 6 games left in the college basketball season. Women's Final Four teams, men's Final Four teams. This weekend is jam-packed with sports, and BetOnline Sportsbook has you covered. Use our promo code BLEAV, B-L-E-A-V, with the link in the description to this episode, and you can get a 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit for however and whenever it is that you so choose to drop that first prognostication. Bet online, where the game starts. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, or good night. However, and whenever it is you may be listening, thank you for stopping on into another fantabulous episode of the Take It Easy podcast, live on the Bleav Podcast Network, except it isn't live because it's a podcast. All podcasts aren't live. It's the whole purpose of podcasts. You can listen however, whenever you so choose. We appreciate you deciding to stop in however and whenever it is that you so choose. On this fantabulous 1,387th episode of the Take It Easy podcast, on a wonderful and wacky April 1st, and that's no joke. Hope you guys are having a great day, a great week. However, and whenever you're listening, we appreciate you stopping in. Normally on the Take It Easy podcast, we have made an emphasis over, call it the last like year and a half. We stopped doing the day-to-day sports analysis and prognostication. We kind of focus on long-form topics, conversations that are going to age better as time goes on, because it is a podcast. We moved to this 3-day-a-week format, so it's more so long-form conversations instead of like, hey, did you see what happened in that basketball game on Sunday night between the New Orleans Pelicans and the Portland Trailblazers? How cool was that? Which, by the way, shout out to the Portland Trailblazers for losing by 60 against the Miami Heat on Friday, and on their graphic on NBA.com, having to see emo Jimmy Butler staring at them as you see a final score of 82-42. I thought that was a funny joke. So the random game between the Portland Trailblazers and Miami Heat was actually kind of noteworthy. But instead of doing that like day-to-day, like, oh, let's react to the games broadcast, we decided to do some long-form podcasting conversations. Today is a day that we are going to break from that mold, because as of approximately 16 hours from now, at the time of this podcast release, which is at 12:01 a.m. West Coast time on the first day of April, about 16 hours from the time that this podcast is released, the LSU Tigers and Iowa State Hawkeyes are going to be playing in the Elite Eight in a rematch of last year's championship game, the part two battle that everyone has been excited about Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese, the two names that you know first and foremost in women's college basketball. If you're going to know any, you remember that crazy tournament run last year with Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark and all that stuff. They're going to play each other. The game that we were super excited about last year is now going to happen again. Unfortunately, it's going to happen at 4 o'clock p.m. West Coast time on a Monday. Tough break in the scheduling for the NCAA Women's March Madness. But we're going to get Caitlin Clark versus Angel Reese Part 2 today. And it's supposed to be the big game of all big games in women's college basketball. Again, unfortunately, it's at 4 o'clock p.m. on a Monday. Tough break. But here's the cool thing about it. As awesome as Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese's duel is going to be, it might not end up being the best game that we see in this Women's March Madness tournament. And the reason I say that is LSU's not as good this year as they were last year. They beat UCLA with Lauren Betts, who's like 6'9". I don't know if anyone saw that game between UCLA and LSU. Lauren Betts is like a 6'9" center that you think of as like the 7'2" NBA center from like 20 years ago just gets the ball in the paint and puts up mid-range and scores inside because no one can really stick with her and you got a double team. Lauren Betts, Jaime Jaquez's sister, Gabriela, I believe is her name. Jaime Jaquez's sister and Lauren Betts and UCLA had LSU by the ropes. I remember going into that weekend, and obviously we didn't do a women's college basketball podcast last week. We did one when the bracket first came out, and when we talked about the women's tournament, we said there were about 6 to 9 teams that were really most captivating going into this tournament, and a few of them have lost already. Sorry, Stanford, and the girl whose name I don't know, but I see her in all the New Balance commercials, the one that goes like, "Hey, you... Yeah, we go together." Remember those New Balance commercials that have like all the players with like Jamal Murray and DeJounte Murray and Kawhi and all and Zach LaVine and all those people in the New Balance commercial that runs in every goddamn NBA broadcast? I forgot the name of the girl who's in the commercial, but she plays for Stanford. Stanford was a number 2 seed. They lost early in the tournament. Sweet 16 Friday, I believe, was when they got knocked out. You had Notre Dame get knocked out of the tournament. You've had a handful of our important teams get knocked out of the tournament. And then you had the matchup that was most exciting up to that point in the tournament, which was LSU and UCLA. And that game was totally awesome and back and forth. And UCLA couldn't hit a three-pointer. And then they finally could hit three-pointers. And they were winning by one late in the game. And then they fouled Angel Reese. And Angel Reese hit 2 free throws. Flauje Johnson was cooking for LSU. I also learned that she's a rapper and has like 3.5 million streams on Spotify, which, like, cool for her. I think in the post-game press conference, she was like, "Yeah, I know I'm going to get discredited because I rap and because I hoop," which, yeah, you know what? I think that I don't see, her having a rap career on the side of being a top Division I college basketball athlete is cool, but it's so unconventional and, as much as I hate to say it, fits into some of the stereotypes that I'm sure Flauje Johnson is talking about when she says she knows she's going to get discredited. Like, yeah, I get it. And it's fucked up that she's disrespected, but also at the same time, like, you know what? I get it. But anyways, so LSU is up 1 after they hit the 2 free throws. They get a block on, I believe it was Betts, get the rebound, fouled Flauje Johnson, so Johnson hits 2 free throws. Now they're up 3, and then they get, I believe, another block. They draw a charge on UCLA on the following possession in a game that had been so tight-knit that UCLA went from getting run out the building to taking the lead to looking like they were going to pull out the win like I thought they were going to from the very beginning. UCLA ends up losing at the end because LSU had 3 consecutive possessions where they came up clutch, got 3 consecutive stops, and hit 4 free throws, and now LSU's in the championship, or in the Elite Eight, with the rematch against Caitlin Clark that everyone was kind of hoping would come through. But at the end of the day, LSU and Iowa was the matchup that everyone wanted to see, even though UCLA might have been better, if not just as good as LSU. But we got our Elite Eight matchup. We got our Iowa. We got our LSU. South Carolina, as of the time of this recording, is still alive on the bracket. I believe they're like 14-point favorites against Oregon State. Sorry, I don't have the result in hand at the time of this recording. Had to record a little bit early because I got a nice double shift of basketball to do on Sunday, so we had to record this podcast a little bit early. Obviously, South Carolina is still alive in the tournament. Texas looks like they might be going to the Final Four, and if it's not Texas, we get a Cinderella NC State team that I know on the men's side everyone's getting excited about because NC State is going on this miraculous run through the tournament to the Elite Eight. But I think it's awesome that those teams are still alive And we got an epic LSU. For the people who do really love college basketball, and for the people who are getting into college basketball now that the women's tournament has reached the Sweet 16 and we're starting to get some of these matchups between the 6 to 9 teams that truly matter in this tournament, now that those 6 to 9 teams are starting to match up against each other, you're starting to get some interest in people who are watching the men's tournament for the first couple rounds like we were, who are now jumping over to the women's side of the tournament. Which, by the way, let me just point out, if you followed our podcast talking about back in March, the women's tournament after conference championship weekend, the bracket breakdown on the Monday after the men's and women's brackets came out, if you followed those two podcasts that we did on the women's tournament, I told you LSU, UCLA, those are two of the six teams that truly matter in this tournament, and both LSU and UCLA are going to be playing each other in the Sweet 16. Both of them made it to the Sweet 16. The game started at 10 a.m. on Saturday. That was a game that was very much worth getting up for, and I hope that people got a chance to get up and watch that game from start to finish, because it was not quite a five-star sporting event, but it was the most entertaining college basketball game with stakes and storylines that I have watched all year. Not since last year's championship game between LSU and Iowa, men's or women's, have I seen a game with so many interesting stakes and storylines. It was very reminiscent of when UCLA played Gonzaga in the men's Sweet 16 last year, and you had these 20 years of storylines between small school from Spokane, Gonzaga, becoming the dominant college basketball program on the West Coast, and them taking them having battles back and forth with UCLA, and Jalen Suggs' half-court shot, and the tension and rivalry that had been building to that Sweet 16 game. You had some of that with LSU and UCLA playing in the Sweet 16, and I hope that people got up at 10 a.m. to watch that game, because in my case, I didn't wake up at 10 a.m. I woke up at 8 a.m., was getting excited to watch UCLA play against LSU, and I got the best possible pregame show leading into the LSU-UCLA game, because 2 hours before the game started, that Washington Post story about that dumbass Kim Mulkey dropped right before their Sweet 16 game, which was awesome, because I got to spend 45 minutes reading about Kim Mulkey and her backstory and the piece that Kent Babb did for the Washington Post, that if you'll remember last week, and we didn't talk about this on the show, that dumbass Kim Mulkey came out, was like, this hit piece that's being done on me is the reason why journalism in America is dying, and this fake news journalistic outlet is doing a damaging hit piece on me, and I want to get out in front and say that we will be suing the Washington Post over this story, which immediately made Kim Mulkey the center of attention for the entire women's tournament at a portion of the tournament where people were not as excited about the basketball themselves. Because as we talked about last week, or a week and a half ago, South Carolina was a 52.5-point favorite in their first-round game. Iowa was a 20-point favorite in their second-round game, the same point spread that Arizona had against Long Beach State in the first round of the tournament. These results in the first round of the women's tournament and first two rounds of the women's tournament were all but foregone conclusions, and like only Duke beating Ohio State was the only shocking result, because of the nine teams that we said mattered in this women's tournament, eight of them made it to the Sweet 16. And so now in the first two rounds of the tournament that didn't have as much excitement on the court in terms of the finality of results, Kim Mulkey becomes the center of attention because this has now become a story of her decrying journalism. This has become a story of, oh, is there going to be a damaging hit piece that possibly costs her more of her reputation than already was on the line? And it turned out that the story itself was a profile done by Kent Babb that detailed how Kim Mulkey got from where she was to now, talked to some former players about the issues that we already knew publicly about Kim Mulkey. But it wasn't this piece that was uncovering Kim Mulkey quotes that were detailing her being abusive to players, or more quotes from Kim Mulkey that we didn't already know about, detailing how she didn't have the support of LGBTQ plus players in the same way that she had support for straight players. And some of this is nuanced, and we'll get into it in a second with the Kim Mulkey story itself. But we didn't really learn that much new information except for these two interesting points, and I think one is more interesting than the other. The first being that Angel Reese might have been suspended at the start of the season because she was flunking out of school. And the second piece of it being Kim Mulkey hasn't talked to her father in 37 years. Which, personally, I think the second one is more interesting than the first one. Like people were gravitating to the fact that it's like, oh yeah, Kim Mulkey's emails and text conversations kind of detailed that, like, Angel Reese was more focused on social media than going to class, and therefore she didn't have the grades to qualify for a Wooden Award list last year, or had to get suspended for 4 games earlier in the season because of something that wasn't really addressed that Mulkey knew about, but it wasn't really brought to the forefront. So I don't really think the whole thing about Angel Reese having grades is whatever. Like, if Angel Reese doesn't want to go to school, Angel Reese shouldn't have to go to school, especially when LSU is essentially operating under the assumption that she is, by definition, an employee, or by all intents and purposes, except for legal definition, an employee of the school. Which, by the way, this is LSU also. Like, LSU has been at the forefront of the game for, we're going to treat these players like employees, man. Like, they have been at the forefront of this game for years. If you're a money-making employee at the University of LSU, which normally just revolves around football, hey, man, we will carve out exception after exception for you. Even in the dirty game of college sports that has been playing the amateurism card for years, LSU has still been at the front of the game when it comes to a lot of that stuff as it relates to, like, players on academic probation. Like, if you all know the story of Tyrann Mathieu eventually got expelled from LSU over some academic stuff, but they were, as long as Tyrann Mathieu was balling, they were willing to, like, go to bat for him for a surprisingly long amount of time when you follow the story that happened with Tyrann Mathieu when he was at LSU. Also, just even beyond the academic stuff, I mean, this is the school that 2 or 3 years ago, we were doing, I think, at least 6 podcasts detailing the rampant culture of sexual assault going on at LSU and cases that were being overlooked by Title IX investigation. It's the school that employed Les Miles for 6 years after he was out here trying to hit on 20-year-old girls while he was the 48-year-old head coach at LSU. This is the school that employed Ed Orgeron and oversaw the shit show that was going on there. Like, this is a morally flexible athletic department by pretty much any standard and definition. Case in point, they're the people who are willing to hire Kim Mulkey. Which brings me back to the piece that Kent Babb did in the Washington Post on Kim Mulkey, because it's a really interesting profile of Kim Mulkey. Like, people are disappointed that it didn't have salacious new details, but for a lot of people, I think they're probably learning for the first time the story of Kim Mulkey and former players and their sexuality, and Kim Mulkey and the shit that was going down at Baylor, which we'll get into in a second. But I'm sure some people were learning those details for the first time. But if you're someone like me, who for a while has said that dumbass Kim Mulkey is impossible to root for because of how morally reprehensible she is as a head coach, like, if you've known that story for years about Kim Mulkey, it wasn't that surprising, some of the details that came out. But I think the way that Kent Babb put the story together was a very good profile. Like, I felt like I learned a lot, not just about Kim Mulkey, but the culture around women's sports, the culture at, like, Baptist institutions like Baylor, how Kim Mulkey kind of came to become this person. I feel like I have a better understanding, even if it's not a perfect understanding, of how Kim Mulkey came to become this vindictive, vengeful, election denying, COVID vaccination true anti-vax truther. The way that Kim Mulkey became this person starts to make more sense when you follow some of the details that are brought up in the story. And I want to talk about the story a little bit, just because, one, trying to preview the LSU-Iowa game is futile, because, like, one, I haven't watched enough women's college basketball to give you X's and O's tape about what's going to happen. And two, the game starts in a minimum of 16 hours from now. And for most of you, probably within like 4 or 5 hours. So I think the more interesting way to go about that is to talk about the Kim Mulkey story. Because like leading into the game, I'm partially glad that LSU advanced, but it also would have been nice to have seen Kim Mulkey get her ass beat as early as possible in the tournament. But Kim Mulkey, so like the story that Kent Babb did on Kim Mulkey, and I want to dive into this a little bit by bit, like go chronologically through the story, because the story itself is really interesting. But the story starts out by talking about Kim Mulkey's successes as a college basketball coach and how she revels in being this heel type of character. And then it starts to turn into a real profile. Like it goes back to her. It gives context for who Kim Mulkey is. You know, 4-time national champion coach, someone who wears crazy outfits on the sidelines, face and coach of a team that is made up of predominantly black stars. And I know last year the championship game trafficked in all the racial aspects of Angel Reese and Flauje Johnson and I forgot the name of the girl who hit all those three-pointers in the championship game who graduated last year. But like playing into all of that, a team of predominantly black stars at LSU winning the national championship is the white face at the top of the program who has some problematic political views. And also, while she's probably not outright homophobic, she more tolerates gay people as like, oh, it's just something that has to exist. Like she doesn't want to have so much interaction with her gay players, but she just kind of goes along tolerating it as if it's just something that, you know, we got to deal with in this sport. We got to deal with the fact that some players are going to be gay, and I'm not going to have as strong a relationship with a lot of those players. And honestly, based on some of the people they talked to, you know, their sexuality played a factor in whether or not they got playing time or stayed at school when Kim Mulkey was coaching them, especially at Baylor University, which, if you don't know, Baylor is the school that one is the largest Baptist university in the country and has specific rules about having sex while not married and specific school guidelines and social, like basically it is a school that uses the cloth of religion to denounce homosexuality on campus and have very specific rules against sex before marriage. And Baylor, while Kim Mulkey was there, the football program was at the heart of one of the largest sexual assault scandals in the country, where they just did not fund a Title IX program. When women were reporting cases of sexual assault among the football program, women were being blamed because the culture of the school is that you're not allowed to have premarital sex. Football players were enabled and protected. Art Briles turned a blind eye to a lot of that stuff. So much so that even in the college football that has this dirty underbelly and like dirt, like a lot of scandal that goes unreported, after the Baylor scandal came to light with like 18 cases of sexual assault that were not investigated properly by Title IX and lawsuits that came from, I think, 21 different women and their families about the failure of institutional protection for women. Even after that entire scandal, Art Briles cannot get another job in college football. And there's Hugh Freeze got another job in college football. Rick Pitino is back at St. John's after a hugely embarrassing scandal on a personal level, along with some stuff about paying players and all that stuff. Like, there are not even Liberty can hire Art Briles. That's how bad everything was going down at Baylor. Like, even Art Briles' son, Kendall Briles, gets connected to everything that happened while he was an assistant at Baylor with his dad because of just how damning that scandal was about rampant sexual assault being turned a blind eye to at Baylor University. And Kim Mulkey famously, after her 500th win, said, She used the platform to go on this giant rant that she feels embarrassed about in hindsight. Like, she's apologized for it. It's been a public stain that even the shit-stained person that she is kind of recognizes. Where after her 500th win, in the midst of the Baylor sexual assault scandal coming up, she went on the microphones after the game and said, if you hear anyone who says, I don't want to send my daughters to Baylor, you should punch them in the face. And while all of this was going on at Baylor, Mulkey is taking it from a program that never made the tournament to winning the national championship in 2013 with her best team ever, which had Brittany Griner as the best player on the team. Brittany Griner and Kim Mulkey have had a public falling out. When Brittany Griner got detained in Russian prison, Kim Mulkey would not publicly support Brittany Griner's release from prison. Now, the story details, she did one time go on a local LSU radio station and say that, you know, we're all praying for Brittany Griner, which is something of a public acknowledgement, but is also far from the effort that she could have put in to show public support for her best former player who, you know, even though they don't have a good relationship anymore, and Brittany Griner has talked publicly about how Kim Mulkey encouraged her to stay in the closet. They never had as strong a relationship as they could have because Mulkey didn't fully accept her for who she is. And a lot of that had to do with her being lesbian. Even as they've had a public falling out, Mulkey's treatment of Griner's situation when she got detained in Russian prison was absolutely not something that instilled confidence in her as a leader or someone who cares about her players. And again, Mulkey's had all sorts of controversies between treatment of gay players, refusing to, when she was at Baylor, refusing to condone sexual assault, threatening journalists who were trying to investigate the Baylor sexual assault scandal. Later on, her being a COVID denier and pushing anti-vax misinformation. When she left to go to LSU, there was all sorts of controversy around it where even Baylor was kind of fed up with her bullshit. And Mulkey, obviously, with the outfits and things like that, Mulkey is very much a, I am the best and I think I should get credit and attention kind of person. Even beyond the outfits, which I don't read too much into the outfits part of that, but there was one part detailed in the Washington Post story that Mulkey is like, even before they built a new arena at Baylor, she was like, I should have my name on that arena. Like, even before they announced that they were building a new arena at Baylor, that's how she felt the kind of impact she had on that school and that program should have been rewarded. Most of that information between the treatment of LGBTQ plus players on her teams and the relationships that she had, the Brittany Griner bullshit, the COVID anti-vax stuff, the threatening reporters during the Baylor sexual assault scandal, all of that stuff was already pretty much known and is pretty consistent with the shitty morals and ethics of Kim Mulkey, which I guess makes her and LSU a pretty perfect pairing. But the thing that I thought was super interesting about the profile was learning how she got there and really working to try and sympathize with Kim Mulkey, or at the very least better understand how Kim Mulkey became the person that she is today. Because the story goes that her father in the 1960s in rural Louisiana inherited 25 acres of land. Him and his brother split the 25 acres, and on his 12 and a half, he built softball fields, he built a pool, he built a basketball court for his daughters, Kim and Tammy, to play sports, have it be a community center, somewhere they could always go out. And like stories of many girls who started playing sports at the very beginnings of the Title IX era, where like women's sports were actually legalized back in the 1970s. he would go out and play basketball at the park, and he would draft Kim on his team, and Kim played with a bunch of 20 and 30 year old men when she was a little kid, and that's where a lot of her evolution of her game came from, despite the fact that she was only 5'4" and 120 pounds, which in this day and age, 5'4" and 120 pounds, you're going to be hard pressed to find any court at a Division I basketball level. But it's 1982. There's just less of a talent pool of talented women's basketball players. And so Kim Mulkey goes to Louisiana Tech. Her dad and her have a tenuous relationship at best at this point, because her father is someone who has a bunch of affairs. He goes to her games and things like that, but he has a bunch of affairs when him and his and Kim's mom get divorced while Kim and Tammy are in college. The relationship is on rocky waters. Kim's father marries someone who's like 30 years younger than him, like pretty close to his daughter's age. And there's all sorts of tenuous stuff in the relationship. But when she's at Louisiana Tech, Kim Mulkey's a point guard. She wins the national championship in 1982. After she finishes her career in 85, she goes into coaching. In 1987, she gets married, and she does not want her father's fiance, or I'm sorry, his father's new wife, to be a part of the wedding. Her father is upset with this. They never settle their disagreement. She walks down the aisle without her father, and she was never going to forgive her father for that. The last time she spoke to her father was right before her wedding in 1987. They never spoke again. That was the end of that relationship. Loyalty had been broken. There wasn't any coming back from it for Kim Mulkey. And I don't know what kind of defense mechanisms someone who's 22 years old in that situation puts up. It's a tough situation to deal with. And Mulkey did not want anything to do with her father after that fact. She kept a relationship with her sister until about 6 or 7 years ago. And Tammy talked about in the Washington Post story, like, they had some sort of argument or disagreement, and they haven't spoken to each other in 6 or 7 years, and she hopes that one day that'll thaw. But there's not much of a relationship there either. They try to reach out to her ex-husband, who asked for a divorce back in 2006, I want to say. And when they got divorced, the story made it sound like they don't talk anymore, despite the fact that their children were getting close to the adult age. And I think that her going through a divorce while her children were around the same age that her father and mother went through a divorce was something that probably really fucked with Kim's head and some of her emotional availability stuff. Because like a lot of people who, I don't want to paint a broad picture of saying fall down the anti-vax rabbit hole or fall into the hole of trying to find information outside of the constructs and traditional sources of information, like, it seems like Kim Mulkey's life can be impossibly lonely. She has two kids. Her daughter is an assistant coach, or at least, was an assistant coach last year on the LSU team. Her son doesn't necessarily go through coaching, but was seemingly an active and willing participant in her life. So I think she still has the relationship with her kids, even if her ex-husband appears to not talk with her anymore. She cut him out. She's cut her father out. Recently, she's cut her sister out of her life. Former players who had some sort of falling out with Kim appear to have some sort of similar response. I remember one girl who was on the 2005 championship team came back for the 15th anniversary team at Baylor and told Kim, like, thank you for being a part of my story. Like, there were good and there was bad, but I learned and grew as a person because of living through it. And Kim didn't acknowledge her. So it seems like for the people who end up leaving the program. Kim Mulkey has ruined some players' careers by painting a picture that they quit, suspensions from the team that may or may not have been associated with their sexuality, or feeling like the relationship with Mulkey changed as soon as conversations around the player's sexuality started happening. All sorts of things that sound really sad, but also paint a picture of a coach who is really good at coaching basketball, has found a style that succeeds in the women's college basketball game to make her one of the five coaches that we all know about, and at the same time sounds kind of emotionally unregulated and at times a bit lonely. And that seems to be the picture that is painted by this story, is someone who, like, appears to not have a lot of deep emotional connection. And it sounds like Kim Mulkey has had some messed up stuff happen in her life up to this point. And granted, she is also someone who has caused harm to a number of people along the way. I say that in a not a demeaning way, but in a way that, like, Kim Mulkey is someone, like, both can be true at the same time. Like, Kim Mulkey's life seems a bit lonely and consumed by the world of sports, and as a result, there's not a whole lot of anything else in her life. And sometimes that not a lot of anything else in her life can also be demeaning to other people in lack of emotional regulation around players, not really having much of, I mean, like, everything that's happened with Brittany Griner in the aftermath and potentially causing more harm than good for a player whom you cared about and she cared about you and you welcomed into this environment at Baylor. Add into that fact that it seems like that a lot of her political beliefs, her stances on cultural issues, her stances on vaccinations, and you know, she gets called the most January 6th of all the January 6th coaches in college basketball. Like, all of that stuff that revolves around Kim Mulkey seems to be stemming from just a general lack of balance that exists in her life, it feels like. And the story ends by giving her dad the last word, which I thought was an interesting way for them to close out the story, is her dad and her daughter kind of get the last word. And what's interesting is that her father is still alive. Her father's 86 years old. He lives in a trailer down in rural Louisiana. And I want to read this part of the story now that is really tough to read at the end. Like, if you go through this whole 40-minute story and this is how it ends, even if it's harder to, like, empathize with Kim Mulkey, it's really, really easy to empathize with her father in the way that it's portrayed at the end. Here's a quote from the end of the story. Quote, "Every once in a while, Les Mulkey climbs into his work truck, drives past the old property that they grew up on, makes his way to the 50 miles south and west to Baton Rouge. He hasn't spoken with his oldest daughter in 37 years, but same as he used to, he can slip into a gym, fade into a crowd, and watch his little girl. I love my babies, he said. I ain't ashamed. Kim has her daddy's eyes, the same skeptical eyebrows, the same pride. They're just alike, younger daughter Tammy says. Tammy said in early March that she doesn't speak to her sister either. There was some disagreement 5 or 6 years ago, but she won't say what caused it. She believes they'll reconnect eventually. I'm sure we will. One day, I hope. Les has no such delusions. Isn't it odd, he says, to love a child so much that you leave them be? It's how Kim wants it, he says, but he prays every night that tomorrow she will want something new. He is 86 now and lives alone in a dilapidated trailer way out past the pines. It's where he retreats after his drives to Baton Rouge. He has dozens of pictures, newspaper cutouts, mementos from Kim's basketball career. Tammy calls it a shrine. It's all he has left of her. And with many of Les's friends dying recently, he thinks about what's next. He was cocky, he says, stubborn, a little too proud. So when his time comes, Les figures it will be when he's alone, surrounded by achievements, but not people, wasting away like the things he once built. Contemplating mortality is a really tough idea for even myself, with someone who's experienced a bunch of loss, but is also 22 years old and a long ways away from his own mortality, I like to think. And so having that be the closing part of the story before they detail how Mulkey is surrounded by people signing autographs, is coaching the best defending champions of women's college basketball, is making $3.2 million per year as the head coach at LSU. One of the things that is interesting is Mulkey, at the end of the story, is portrayed in this similar type of vein, where once everyone leaves, all the crowds and all the cheering fans asking for photos and autographs, it's Mulkey by herself, without her kids, without her family, without her ex-husband. It's Mulkey by herself at the end of it all. She's got herself, she's got her coaching, and that's what seems to sustain her at this point. And as someone who's going into her 60s, it sounds like an impossibly lonely life at the end, but also one that's filled with a whole bunch of successes and things that bring a whole lot of joy and fun, and coaching has been her purpose. I mean, she's given it her entire adult life. But the way that she got to where she is now appears to have caused a bunch of heartache and suffering for a bunch of people. And as a leader, she seems to have come short in a whole bunch of places. Not the least of which begins with what we saw last week, when she's coming out and going after reporters. And it's not the first time someone with Republican views or someone with questionable moral character is going after journalism, specifically journalism that's being done about herself. That's not the new thing. But it's the reaction to a story that, one, is a profile, and two, helped me learn something interesting about Kim Mulkey and made me empathize with, at the very least, her family, if not a little bit about her and her upbringing. It helped provide context to the person who has been, in my eyes, viewed as a villain, viewed as someone antagonistic towards LGBTQ plus people, or at the very least just tolerates them and does the bare minimum, and at worst is antagonistic towards LGBTQ plus players, someone who is not there for former teammates. That coach, and by the way, someone who is, like, as I've said, the most January 6th of the January 6th coaches. A morally reprehensible coach who has made a ton of missteps along the way, made it a little bit easier to provide context for that and empathize with some of the people in her family who have made mistakes, come to the conclusions of their mistakes, and kind of live with it at this point. And while other people try to move on, Kim doesn't necessarily give the same hope of wanting to move on, at least not as for anything that doesn't relate to basketball. And so I just thought it was interesting that her response to everything that was in that story, even though she didn't know exactly what the story was going to be, her response did more harm than good. And I think that's a lot of the questionable actions around Kim Mulkey, is, are you doing as much harm as the good that you're providing for a lot of these people? And she's doing more harm than most coaches publicly facing. I don't know if that's a sign of good leadership or bad leadership or getting the results that you want or whatever it is, but this is the world that Kim Mulkey was pushed towards, and this has been her life. I don't know if it's the life she would have chosen out at the beginning, but she's here now, and we'll see what ends up happening. But this whole story around Kim Mulkey was something that I found to be incredibly interesting, and I hope that you guys got something interesting out of it too as we get ready for this wonderful LSU versus Iowa battle that's about to go down here today. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for stopping in here to the Take It Easy podcast. We got episodes every Monday, Wednesday, Thursday here on the show. We got all sorts of great content coming at you, all sorts of fun basketball conversations, pro and college, as we get into the beginning of basketball playoffs, the end of this college basketball season. I'm excited for Final Four talk the rest of the week. We'll probably have an NBA show coming up at some point. Stay tuned for all sorts of great content. We will talk to you again tomorrow. And in the meantime, take it easy.